Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. If you haven't already done so, please make sure the volume of this podcast is set perfectly to your listening enjoyment. Please take your seat, whether that's on the treadmill, car, sofa, or bed, and buckle in for the last trip. My name is Jamie Beebe, and I'll be your tour guide, recreating someone's last days in paradise. On behalf of myself and everyone behind the scenes, please enjoy the Last Trip podcast. And because nobody likes a long flight to get to where they want to be, let's prepare for takeoff. Graham Norris Horn was 21 years old when he disappeared in rural Virginia. On August 15, 2024, Graham was traveling with a faith-based group when they stopped for gas at a truck stop in Bracy. According to investigators, there was some kind of disagreement. Graham walked away. He didn't have a phone, he didn't know the area, and he had no known ties to the community. But what happened next would turn a missing person case into something far more disturbing. Weeks later, workers at a church about 6 miles away noticed a terrible smell coming from an old well. At the bottom, they found Graham. Investigators would eventually treat his death as a homicide. But questions remain about what happened after Graham left that truck stop, and how he ended up at the bottom of a well outside a church. Normally at this point in the last trip, we'd leave the investigation behind for a few minutes and talk about the place our traveler was visiting. But Graham wasn't on vacation. So instead of talking about a destination today, I want to pivot and talk about the organization Graham was traveling with when he disappeared. Because the more I looked into Met by Love Ministries, the more questions I had. Met by Love Ministries is a North Carolina-based nonprofit that describes itself as a faith-based recovery program for men struggling with addiction, alcoholism, homelessness, depression, PTSD, and something the organization calls fatherlessness. According to its website, the ministry offers a no-cost 12-month residential recovery program intended to help men rebuild their lives through Christianity, discipleship, and community. And on the surface, honestly, it sounds wonderful. A place where a man who has nowhere else to go can get a roof over his head, food, clothing, transportation, and someone checking on him. Those things matter, especially when you're dealing with addiction. It also operates street outreach and says it distributes necessities to homeless people while offering prayer and spiritual guidance. And I want to make something really clear before I go any further. I'm not anti-religion. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with incorporating faith into addiction treatment. For many people, religion genuinely does provide community, accountability, purpose, and hope. There are people who will tell you that their faith saved their lives. My issue comes when we're talking about serious medical and psychological conditions. Addiction, depression, PTSD. And I start looking for the part where qualified mental health and medical professionals come into the picture. Because on Met by Love's public-facing program pages, faith is not just part of the treatment philosophy. Faith appears to be the center of it. The organization's founder, Sean Day, says he created Met by Love Ministries in 2018 and believes people can overcome addiction through what the ministry describes as the transformative power of God's Word. Scripture is described as a cornerstone of recovery, healing, and spiritual growth. Their motto is, "Our passion for broken hearts to be made whole again by the power of God's presence and the beauty of discipleship." It's beautiful language. but beautiful language and clinical treatment aren't necessarily the same thing. And that's where I started getting uncomfortable. Because let's take drug addiction. Met by Love describes its approach as a combination of spiritual guidance, prayer, community support, and what it calls traditional recovery methods. Okay, what traditional recovery methods? That's what I wanted to know. There aren't descriptions of licensed addiction counselors, no biographies of psychiatrists, no explanations of medication-assisted treatment, or details about evidence-based therapies. No explanation of what happens medically if someone arrives physically dependent on alcohol or opioids and needs supervised detoxification. Instead, the page talks about developing a deeper spiritual connection and lists Bible verses. Met by Love's Charity Navigator profile says the organization describes its vision as including counseling, group therapy, life skills training, and recreational activities. The profile also says the nonprofit reports using an evidence-based curriculum in a classroom setting. So I'm not saying those things definitely don't happen. I'm saying that when I looked at the actual public program descriptions for people potentially deciding whether to place a vulnerable family member into this year-long program, I personally wanted a lot more detail about who provides that counseling, what qualifications they have, and exactly what traditional recovery methods means. Because addiction is not simply a spiritual problem. It's a medical problem, a psychological problem, and a social problem. A prayer can absolutely coexist with treatment, but it can't replace treatment. Their alcoholism program uses very similar language. It describes faith-based healing as a holistic solution, and again, refers generally to traditional recovery methods. But there isn't much detail about what that holistic solution actually consists of. Instead, the focus is spiritual counseling and encouraging participants to strengthen their religious beliefs as a foundation for sobriety. And then we get into what might be my favorite category on the website, fatherlessness. And when I first saw it listed beside drug addiction, alcoholism, depression, and PTSD, I genuinely stopped, because one of these things is not like the others. Having an absent father can absolutely cause trauma. It can affect attachment, self-esteem, and relationships. So I'm not minimizing that at all. But fatherlessness is not a medical diagnosis. Yet Met by Love places it prominently alongside recognized mental health and substance use conditions as something its faith-based program addresses. The ministry describes fatherlessness in terms of profound emotional and psychological effects and presents the program as a nurturing environment for healing and personal growth. And again, maybe some men desperately need exactly that kind of supportive male community. I can completely understand that. But it also illustrates what this organization fundamentally is. This isn't a conventional rehab that happens to offer Bible study. This is a Christian discipleship ministry that presents itself as a recovery program. And that's an important distinction. And the same thing happens when you read their description of depression. Met by Love calls its approach a compassionate and holistic path to managing and overcoming depression. Participants are encouraged to strengthen their spiritual connection and find comfort and strength through faith. The foundational resources listed immediately beneath the description are passages from Psalms and Romans. Again, prayer, spiritual guidance, and community support, a journey of faith and healing, and then more Bible passages. Maybe that is incredibly helpful for some people. I genuinely hope it is. But if you're inviting men suffering from PTSD, severe depression, addiction, and homelessness to live under your supervision for an entire year, I think the standard of care should be extraordinarily high. Because these aren't people attending Sunday Bible study. These are potentially medically and psychologically vulnerable men. And that context becomes especially important when you think about Graham's disappearance and what kind of people were responsible for him when he vanished. Now, the financial side of this organization is interesting too. Met by Love isn't just a loose group of guys with Bibles traveling around in a van. It's an established 501c3 nonprofit. IRS filings compiled by ProPublica showed that the organization reported more than $1 million in revenue in 2022, about $910,000 in 2023, and approximately $754,000 in 2024. And in 2024, about $695,000 of its $754,000 in revenue came from contributions. Now that's roughly 92%. So donations are not a side activity. They are overwhelmingly how this organization survives. Met by Love's public nonprofit filings also show other activities. In 2023, its reported programs included faith-based housing and clothing, a gift shop, and a lawn care business. Now, the ministry itself describes the lawn care operation as both a fundraising program and a way for participants to learn practical employment skills. And I don't inherently have a problem with that either. Teaching someone recovering from addiction how to show up to work every morning, work on a team, maintain a schedule, and develop an employable skill is incredibly beneficial. That's real-world recovery. But whenever vulnerable people living inside a residential program are also participating in activities that generate money for the organization housing them, I think transparency becomes very important. How many hours are they working? Are they paid? At what point are they paid? Are they free to decline? How much of their time is spent receiving treatment versus fundraising, traveling, or working? And those are all perfectly reasonable questions. A listing from Met by Love through CityGate Network actually says participants may be offered an internship and paycheck at around 8 months into the program, and potentially employment with the ministry after completing 12 months. It describes the organization as a faith-based deliverance ministry focused on spiritual strongholds and inner healing. Again, that language tells you exactly what kind of program this is. Spiritual first, and everything else seems to grow around it. And there are people who clearly appreciate what Met by Love does. The organization's own website features testimonials thanking the ministry for its work with people struggling with addiction and veterans. One person says the ministry really touched my soul. And those testimonials matter. It would be unfair to simply ignore people who say they've seen something positive come from the organization. But I also went looking for independent reviews. And interestingly, there isn't a massive body of easily verifiable former participant reviews online, at least not that I could find. And that absence isn't evidence of anything sinister. But for a residential program that has operated for years and reported hundreds of thousands of dollars in annual revenue, I would personally love to hear more directly from the men who have actually completed the 12 months. How many people enter? How many finish? How many remain sober a year later? How many relapse? How many receive professional mental health treatment while they're there? How many transition into independent housing and employment? Those are the numbers I care about. There is one independent benchmark we can look at. As of 2026, Charity Navigator gives Met by Love Ministry a 72% score and a 2-star rating out of 4. And that doesn't mean Charity Navigator is saying it's a bad organization. A 2-star rating isn't a declaration of fraud or misconduct, but it also isn't exactly a glowing endorsement. The organization's tax records offer another interesting snapshot. For 2024, Met by Love reported about $811,000 in expenses against approximately $754,000 in revenue, meaning expenses exceeded revenue by roughly $56,000. And that same filing reports approximately $245,000 in compensation among three top officers: Tanya Day at $82,900, Sean Day at $81,050, and Joseph Hagler at $81,050. Again, salaries themselves aren't suspicious. People running nonprofits are allowed to earn money. Operating a residential program requires work. And this is also where I need to clear up something confusing that comes up when you search the name online. There is another religious movement called Met by Love, connected to an organization called the Every Heart Movement in Michigan. And that group has generated quite a bit of negative discussion online, including Reddit posts in which former participants and observers describe it as overly controlling, emotionally intense, or cult-like. But after digging into this, I do not believe we can responsibly attribute those reviews to the North Carolina Met by Love Ministries involved in Graham's case. Every Heart says its version of Met by Love began as a college campus worship ministry in Michigan and later became part of the Every Heart movement. The North Carolina organization connected to Graham was separately founded by Sean Day and has a different leadership structure, location, mission, and nonprofit registration. So despite the identical name and some superficial similarities, they appear to be different organizations. And that's worth saying because once you start labeling something as a cult, that word sticks. It's an incredibly serious characterization. And I couldn't find any mainstream academic, governmental, or religious authority that has formally classified the North Carolina Met by Love Ministries as a cult. What I will say is that it appears to be an intensely faith-centered residential program serving an exceptionally vulnerable population. And personally, whenever those two things come together, I think scrutiny is healthy. Not because Christianity is suspicious, but because power deserves scrutiny. The group potentially has an enormous amount of influence over one person's life. Maybe that influence is used beautifully. Maybe it saves lives. But safeguards matter precisely because vulnerable people can become extremely dependent on the institutions helping them. So I think it's reasonable to ask, what does that responsibility look like once you leave the facility? What happens when you're hundreds of miles from home? Who's supervising these trips? Is there a clinical professional traveling with them? What happens when someone experiencing addiction or psychological distress becomes upset and walks away? What's the protocol? Do you call his emergency contact? Do you call police? Does someone follow him? Does someone stay behind? Now, the group couldn't make Graham stay with them, but they also left him behind. There was an entire spectrum of possibilities between physically restraining Graham and returning to North Carolina without him. And knowing where Graham ultimately ended up makes that impossible for me to ignore. So I think his death makes understanding this organization and understanding exactly what happened during that trip not just interesting background, but it becomes part of the story. Because when an organization asks families to trust them with men who are addicted, depressed, traumatized, or homeless, I think they take on something more than a religious mission. They take on responsibility. And whatever eventually happened to Graham Horn, I think his family deserves to know exactly how serious that responsibility was taken.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Before we get into what happened to Graham, I think it's important to understand who Graham actually was. Because Graham was complicated. He was only 21 years old. He had already been through difficult periods in his life. He had reportedly gotten into serious trouble. And by the summer of 2024, he seemed to be trying to figure out where his life was going. But none of that is the sum of who he was. Graham Norris Horn was born on December 16, 2002, in Stanley County, North Carolina, to Charles Harrison, Charlie Horn II, and Jillian Dawn, Jill Lear. He grew up in a large family with siblings Chase, Caden, Easton, and Haven Horn, along with Haley and Lawson Treadaway. His extended family also included grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins. And from the way his family described him after his death, Graham seems to have been someone who really loved being around people. His obituary describes him as having a good heart, someone who could help the people around him, and someone who loved his family. It says that he lived his life to the fullest. He was a really good listener. There are people who could talk to anyone, and then there are people who make you feel like you can talk to them. And that was Graham. He loved animals, the beach, and surfing. And I actually think those details help paint a much more vivid picture of him than any mugshot, police report, or missing person flyer ever could. But he was also trying to navigate a life that apparently hadn't been very easy. There are online references to Graham having previously faced an extremely serious criminal allegation in Anson County, North Carolina, involving attempted first-degree murder. But I have not been able to independently verify the complete court record, or, more importantly, the ultimate disposition of that case from a reliable primary source. So I don't think it would be responsible to simply say that Graham attempted to murder someone. Being arrested or charged with a crime is not the same thing as being convicted of it. And we don't know the story behind it. What does appear clear is that Graham had experienced some significant instability before his death. And personally, I think that context makes what happened to him even sadder. Because sometimes when a young person has gotten into trouble, people unconsciously start treating whatever happens to them afterward as somehow less tragic, as if their life is worth a little less. And I really hate that. Whatever mistakes he made, whatever trouble he had gotten into, whatever conflicts existed in his family or his life, he still had decades ahead of him to change direction. And it appears that changing direction may have been part of how Met by Love entered his life. Unfortunately, there is surprisingly little reliable public information explaining exactly how Graham first became connected with the organization, or precisely what his relationship with them was. What we do know is that by August 2024, Graham was traveling with members of the organization when they passed through Mecklenburg County, Virginia. And because of this string of events, his life ended in one of the strangest and most disturbing circumstances imaginable. Now, to understand how a 21-year-old from North Carolina ended up at the bottom of a well outside a small church in rural Virginia, we have to go back to that August road trip with Met by Love Ministries, and to the moment Graham walked away from a truck stop and seemingly disappeared.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
By August of 2024, Graham Horn was trying to change his life. He was looking for a way forward. But his time with the program was becoming more complicated than he expected. They say Graham and other participants were traveling to different communities, setting up tables outside businesses, and selling merchandise or soliciting donations to support the ministry. Graham was traveling with three members of Met by Love on this kind of fundraising trip when the group stopped in Bracy, Virginia to sell Christian literature. It was because of these sales that Graham believed he was being put to work fundraising to help cover the cost of his own stay. Until something happened on that trip that made Graham decide he was done. There were claims that the group had encountered problems soliciting donations at a tractor supply location and had been told to leave. Family advocates said Graham became concerned about whether what they were doing was permitted or possibly illegal. And he definitely did not want to get in more trouble with law enforcement. Bracy, Virginia is a small community in Mecklenburg County, not far from the North Carolina border and Lake Gaston. Interstate 85 runs through the area connecting Virginia and North Carolina. So this was not Graham's neighborhood. And he'd never been there and had no known ties to the community, and he also didn't have a cell phone with him. The official report initially released by investigators was fairly simple. The group stopped at Simmons to get fuel. Graham got into what authorities called a disagreement with some of the people he was traveling with, and then he walked away, heading east. But witnesses give us a lot more detail about what the day actually looked like. Shirley Tisdale, a manager at Simmons Travel Center, was working when the Met by Love group arrived. Now, according to Shirley, they set up a table and remained there for hours, from around 11:30 that morning until approximately 5 p.m. that afternoon. And Graham kept coming inside, not to buy snacks or wander around the store, but instead to use the phone. Shirley remembered him making several calls throughout the day. According to Graham's family, some of those calls were to his father and grandmother. There was reportedly also a three-way conversation involving Graham, his grandmother, and someone connected with the recovery program. Whatever was happening, Graham apparently had made a decision. He was leaving. Family accounts say that before he walked away, Graham said something that would take on a haunting significance after his disappearance. He said, "I'm leaving, and God is going with me." Shirley, the gas station manager, she actually saw him go. Interestingly, she told the Mecklenburg Sun that despite the sheriff's office describing a disagreement between Graham and members of the group, she personally hadn't noticed any obvious signs of an argument while they were there. But she did remember seeing Graham leave the property on foot alone. Imagine being Graham in that moment. You're 21 years old, you're in a place you don't know, you don't have your phone, no money or identification with you. And you've just decided that whatever happens next, you're not getting back into that vehicle. So you start walking, but you don't even know where you are. Now, the rest of the group eventually left Simmons and returned to North Carolina. The ministry later released a statement saying they had tried to help Graham in every way possible, that they could not hold him against his will, and that they waited for him to return before leaving Virginia. But Graham didn't return. And according to his family, they weren't even immediately told he was gone. Graham's relatives have said they only discovered he had separated from the group after they couldn't reach him. And that's when his grandmother contacted the ministry herself. And that part of the story would become a major source of frustration for Graham's family. His father later publicly accused members of Met by Love of failing to notify him promptly that Graham had disappeared. And there were screenshots posted on Facebook of text exchanges between Graham's father and a member of the organization in which his father confronted the ministry about not telling him that Graham was missing. Either way, eventually Graham was reported missing and authorities began looking for him. The Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office circulated surveillance photographs of Graham and asked the public for help. Their missing person alert stressed how vulnerable his circumstances were. Graham was on foot, without a phone, and had no idea where he was. But then, nothing. Days passed, then weeks. There were no confirmed phone calls, no confirmed sightings, no indication that Graham had made it back to North Carolina. He seemed to have simply vanished somewhere in rural Mecklenburg County. And then, exactly 1 month after Graham was last seen, something happened at a small church several miles away. On Monday, September 16th, workers were at St. Stephen RZUA Church on Highway 903 in Bracy. The church sits about 6 miles east of Simmons Travel Center. People working around the property noticed a terrible odor. They traced it toward a well near the front of the church property. According to Graham's grandfather, contractors removed the cement cover and looked inside. And floating in the water, they saw a shoe. Then, looking farther down, they realized there appeared to be a body in the well. At approximately 12:17 that afternoon, first responders were dispatched to the property for what was initially described as a possible body in a well. This was approximately 50 feet down and extremely narrow, reported to be only about 2 feet wide. Recovering whoever was inside was going to require a technical rescue operation. The Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office responded along with the South Hill Volunteer Fire Department, Lake Gaston Fire Department, and Southside Rescue. Firefighters established backup teams and safety personnel before someone descended into the well to retrieve the remains. And eventually, they brought the body to the surface. Outside the well, investigators reportedly found another shoe consistent with the footwear Graham had been wearing when he disappeared. But there was another detail about this well that I find incredibly strange. It had a very heavy cement cover over the opening of the well. And according to members of the St. Stephen Church, at some point they had noticed that the lid was off, and they put it back on. Investigators declined to publicly say exactly when church members noticed the lid had been moved. But that immediately raises a lot of questions. Was the well uncovered when Graham arrived there? If it was, how long had it been open? Did Graham fall? Did he climb down? Was someone else there? And if the lid was replaced sometime after Graham entered the well, did whoever replaced it have any idea that Graham was underneath it? Or had someone intentionally removed and then perhaps later replaced that cover? Those questions sound ominous, but they are questions and not answers. Because even today, publicly available information does not tell us exactly how Graham entered that well. So his remains were transported to the office of the Chief Medical Examiner of Virginia. And the following day, investigators received confirmation of the identity. Fingerprints established that the person recovered from the well was Graham Norris Horn. From the beginning, investigators treated the circumstances seriously. Captain Chris Whittemore of the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office explained that investigators approach cases like this as homicides until the evidence establishes otherwise. So police began trying to reconstruct that missing month. Investigators collected evidence from the area and reviewed surveillance footage, including cameras around the church property and nearby businesses. There was an obvious problem. A month had already passed. Motion-activated security systems don't necessarily retain footage indefinitely. By the time Graham's body was discovered, some potentially important video from the period immediately after his disappearance no longer existed. And investigators still had an enormous 6-mile question mark between Simmons Travel Center and St. Stephen's Church. Did Graham walk the entire distance? Did someone pick him up? Did anyone see him along Highway 903? Was he alive when he reached the church? And how soon after walking away did he die? Authorities initially would not say how long they believed Graham had been inside the well, and they couldn't immediately say how he died. A complete forensic examination could take months. Now, meanwhile, Met by Love publicly said its members were fully cooperating with authorities. But when the Mecklenburg Sun directly asked Captain Whittemore whether members of the ministry were cooperating with the homicide investigation, his answer was noticeably more guarded. He only said, to some degree, and didn't explain what he meant. I think it's important not to read more into those three words than we actually know. There's no public evidence establishing that anyone from Met by Love killed Graham, and there's been no publicly identified suspect. And the fact that Graham had a disagreement with members of the organization does not mean that disagreement caused his death. The months after Graham's death, his grandfather Charles was still searching for answers, making the trip from Myrtle Beach area to Mecklenburg County almost every week. He walked the roads, knocked on doors, talked to people who lived near the places Graham had last been seen. Because he simply couldn't accept that his grandson had somehow ended up in that well without another person being involved. Charles fully believed Graham's death was a homicide, and he said something that really summarizes the mystery at the center of this case. That Graham didn't crawl in that well by himself. Of course, that is his grandfather's belief and not a proven conclusion. But it's also the question hanging over this entire story. How did Graham get into the well? As of July 2026, I can find no credible public reporting announcing a final cause and manner of death from Virginia's medical examiner. No publicly announced arrest, and no explanation from authorities of what they believe happened during Graham's final hours. So we're left with two locations 6 miles apart. At one end is Simmons Travel Center. Graham's alive, making phone calls, seen by witnesses, and eventually he walks away. At the other end is a small rural church and a 50-foot well with a heavy cover. Now, somewhere between those two places is the answer to what happened to Graham Horn.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
So how did Graham Horn go from standing at a truck stop in rural Virginia in the middle of the afternoon to being found dead at the bottom of a well 6 miles away? I want to be clear before we get into the theories. Investigators have not publicly identified a suspect, and nobody has been charged with Graham's death. But the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office was investigating his death as a homicide. And that distinction matters. Police weren't simply investigating a missing person who was later found dead. They were trying to determine whether someone else was responsible for how Graham ended up in that well. And when you look at the circumstances, I can totally understand why. The last known chapter of Graham's life begins with Met by Love Ministries. Met by Love later posted a statement on social media saying they had tried to help Graham in every way they could. They said that when Graham chose to leave, they couldn't hold him against his will. They waited for him to come back before eventually returning to North Carolina. And legally, of course, Graham was 21 years old. He was an adult. They couldn't physically force him into a vehicle. But that doesn't necessarily answer the bigger question for me. What responsibility did this organization have toward the vulnerable people traveling with them? Because Graham wasn't walking away from a disagreement in his own neighborhood. He was in rural Virginia. And then the group drove back to North Carolina without him. Maybe they genuinely believed Graham would be fine. Maybe they thought he needed some space and would eventually find his way home. But knowing what happened afterward, it's difficult not to look back at that decision and wonder what they could have done differently. And Graham's family had questions about the group's actions almost immediately. And this brings us to the first theory. Could someone Graham was traveling with have been involved in his death? Now, I think this possibility has to be considered simply because these were among the last people known to have been with him. Police themselves reported that Graham had been involved in a disagreement with members of the group shortly before he walked away. And we don't know what the disagreement was about. We don't know how serious it was. And we don't know exactly what happened between the time Graham left and the time the others returned to North Carolina. We also have to remember that Graham wasn't the only person traveling with the ministry. Local reporting says three other members were with him at the truck stop that day. While we know very little publicly about those individuals, that does not make them suspects. But if you're investigating a suspicious death, you obviously want to understand the movements of every person who was around the victim shortly before he disappeared. Where did everyone go after Graham walked away? How long did they actually wait? Did anyone leave the truck looking for him? Did anyone encounter Graham again? When did they decide to leave Virginia? And what exactly was the disagreement that supposedly preceded his disappearance? Those are questions investigators need to answer. And personally, even if absolutely nobody associated with the organization had anything to do with Graham's death, I still struggle with how the situation was handled. I understand the argument that Graham was an adult and couldn't legally be forced to stay. But there's a huge difference between physically restraining someone and simply making sure a vulnerable young man isn't abandoned without a phone in an unfamiliar place. You could follow him from a safe distance. You could call his family. You could call police and say, hey, we're concerned about someone traveling with us who has walked away and doesn't know this area. You could have someone stay behind. You could look for him. These were options between restraining Graham and simply leaving Virginia without him. And maybe there are things Met by Love did that have never been made public. We don't know the entire story. And then there's another possibility. What if everything Met by Love said happened exactly as they described it? Graham becomes upset, walks away, they wait, he doesn't come back, so eventually they leave. And whatever happened to Graham happened afterward. And that opens up an entirely different set of possibilities. Maybe Graham was walking along the road and was hit by a vehicle. Someone is driving through rural Virginia, possibly at night, hits a pedestrian, they panic. Maybe they're intoxicated. Maybe they don't have insurance. Maybe they have a criminal record. Maybe they're simply terrified of going to prison. So instead of calling 911, they hide Graham's body. It's horrifying, but hit-and-run drivers have concealed victims before. And a well would certainly hide a body. But this theory raises another problem. Why that well? St. Stephen RZUA Church was about 6 miles from the truck stop where Graham was last seen. Was Graham hit near the church, or did someone transport him there? Did the person responsible already know the well existed? Because this wasn't just an open hole beside the road. This well was approximately 2 feet wide, 50 feet deep, and covered by a heavy lid. And here's one of the strangest details in this entire case. Church members had apparently noticed at some point the lid was off the well, so they replaced it. But didn't they see his shoe? Did they look inside? Because weeks later, Graham's body was discovered inside that well. Now to me, establishing exactly when that lid was found, displaced, could be incredibly important. Was it shortly after August 15th? Was Graham already inside the well when church members replaced it without realizing it? Could that help narrow down when he arrived there? And who removed the lid in the first place? And then there's the possibility involving drugs. We know Graham made several phone calls from inside the truck stop that day, but we don't publicly know who all of those calls were made to. So you could theorize that Graham somehow contacted someone who supplied him with drugs, that he overdosed, and whoever was with him panicked and disposed of his body. But personally, I find that theory less convincing. Graham was in an area where authorities said he had no local connections. He didn't have his own phone. And by all accounts, he was trying to get his life back on track. Could he have found drugs? Of course. Addiction doesn't follow convenient logic. And none of us know exactly what Graham was thinking that day. But for that theory to explain where he was ultimately found, several things have to happen. Graham has to find a drug connection in an unfamiliar rural area, meet that person, overdose, and then that person has to know about a covered well on church property 6 miles away, and then decide to put Graham inside it. Is it possible? Yes. But based on what we currently know, it requires a lot of assumptions. And then there's another theory that inevitably comes up in cases like this. Could Graham have entered the well himself? Could he have been experiencing some kind of mental health crisis after leaving the truck stop? Could he have walked the 6 miles, reached the church, discovered the well, removed the cover, and climbed or fallen inside? Again, technically, almost anything is possible. But I have a hard time making this scenario fit the physical circumstances. Graham would first have to travel roughly 6 miles from the truck stop to this particular church property. Was Met by Love somehow affiliated with this church? Then he would have to discover a relatively narrow well and then somehow remove its heavy lid, and then either deliberately enter or accidentally fall into it. If this were suicide, we would also have to assume Graham somehow knew that entering this particular well would kill him. And there's no publicly reported evidence that Graham was suicidal. His grandfather certainly does not believe he was. And months after Graham was found, Charles Horn was still driving from Myrtle Beach to Mecklenburg County almost every week, walking the roads, knocking on doors, trying to find information himself. He told CBS 6 that he was convinced Graham's death was a homicide, and he did not believe his grandson entered that well on his own. And I understand why he feels that way. Because the well itself is what I keep coming back to. If Graham had simply been found somewhere in the woods, you can imagine dozens of accidental scenarios. He gets lost, becomes dehydrated, suffers an overdose or medical emergency. But Graham wasn't found lying somewhere along the route. He was found inside that well, covered by a heavy lid. And that doesn't automatically prove murder, but it demands an explanation. How did he get inside? Was he alive when he entered? Was there water in his lungs? Were there injuries consistent with a fall? Was there evidence of trauma that occurred before he entered the well? Were drugs or alcohol found in his system? Was there any indication that his body had been moved? And those are the kinds of questions an autopsy could potentially help answer. But unfortunately, those answers have not been publicly released. When Graham's body was discovered in September 2024, Captain Whittemore said a complete autopsy could take as long as 8 months. And we're now well beyond that timeline. I searched for subsequent reporting, medical examiner findings, arrests, and updates through 2026. I could not find a credible public release giving Graham's official cause or manner of death. And from his family's social media accounts, they don't have those answers either. Even in December 2024, 3 months after Graham was found, investigators were still publicly saying they were trying to determine how he died. That's incredibly frustrating. Maybe the ministry's version of events is completely accurate, and maybe Graham encountered someone after walking away. Maybe someone driving down that road hit him. Maybe he met someone we don't know about. Maybe something happened involving one or more of the people he'd been traveling with. Or maybe there's another explanation nobody outside the investigation has even considered. But there are pieces of this story that deserve answers. Most importantly, the question that has been there since Graham was found. How does a 21-year-old man walk away from a truck stop in broad daylight and end up dead inside a covered well 6 miles away? Until investigators explain that, I don't think Graham's family is unreasonable for continuing to question what happened. Because somebody may know something. Someone may have seen Graham walking that afternoon. Someone may know who he spoke with. Someone may remember a vehicle near the church. Someone may know when that well cover was removed. And maybe one small piece of information is all investigators need to finally connect the truck stop to that well. Until the medical examiner's findings are released, or investigators tell the public what they believe happened, we can't say definitively that Graham was murdered. But we can say that law enforcement investigated his death as a homicide. And more than a year after Graham's body was discovered, the most basic question remains unanswered. What happened to Graham Horne?
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Usually when we talk about travel safety on the last trip, we're talking about things like watching your drink, keeping your passport safe, or not wandering around somewhere unfamiliar late at night. But Graham's case brings up a very different kind of safety issue. What happens when you're traveling with an organization that is also providing your housing, transportation, recovery program, religious community, and most of your daily structure? Because at that point, you're not really traveling independently anymore. You're depending on the group. And that creates a whole different set of risks. So my first piece of advice is simple. Never allow a group to become your only way home. I don't care whether you're traveling with a church, rehab, volunteer organization, missionary group, tour company, or friends. You should always know how you can get yourself somewhere safe without them. You should have identification. You should have access to a phone. You should have important phone numbers written down somewhere besides your phone. And ideally, you should have access to at least some money that nobody else controls. Because group travel can create a false sense of security. You think, I'm with a bunch of people, what could happen? But sometimes traveling with a group actually makes you less independent. Someone else is driving. Someone else knows where you're sleeping. Someone else controls the itinerary. Maybe you've never even looked at the map. And if you suddenly become separated from them, you may not know the town you're in, where you're staying, or how to get back. And that's especially concerning when we're talking about addiction recovery. People entering treatment are often doing so during one of the most vulnerable periods of their lives. Some may be homeless. Some may be estranged from family. Some may be dealing with depression, PTSD, or trauma. Some may be newly sober. That vulnerability is exactly why I would research a recovery organization far more carefully than I would research a hotel. Ask whether treatment programs and their healthcare professionals are licensed or accredited and whether they use evidence-based treatments such as cognitive behavioral therapy, motivational interviewing, and appropriate medications when medically indicated. And personally, those are questions I would ask before I ever got into the van. Who is actually responsible for me? Is there a licensed addiction counselor, a doctor, a therapist, someone trained to handle a mental health crisis? What happens if I relapse? What happens if I go into withdrawal? What happens if I have a panic attack? And maybe most importantly, what happens if I decide I want to leave? Ask that before joining any residential program. Do you keep your identification? Do you keep your phone? Do you control your own money? Can you contact your family privately? Can your family visit? Can you see an outside doctor? Are you expected to work or solicit donations? And if you're traveling and fundraising, how much of your day is actually spent doing that? And those aren't cynical questions. They're safety questions. Any organization working with vulnerable people should be comfortable answering them. And I would always make sure someone outside the organization knows exactly where you're going. Not, I'm traveling around Virginia with the ministry. Virginia is a big state. Give someone the organization's name. Tell them where you're staying. Give them the names and phone numbers of the people you're traveling with. Share your location if possible. And establish regular check-ins. Even something as simple as, hey mom, we're in Mecklenburg County tonight. Everything's fine. Because if someone disappears, knowing exactly where they were the night before makes a huge difference. Graham's case demonstrates that painfully well. Once Graham walked away, investigators were trying to reconstruct the movements of someone who didn't have an established life in that area. He wasn't going home. He wasn't going to work. He wasn't visiting a friend. There wasn't an obvious place investigators could assume he was headed. Then there's the geography itself. Virginia has plenty of rural roads where you can quickly find yourself miles from businesses, sidewalks, or public transportation. Virginia DMV advises pedestrians to use sidewalks when available, stay visible, and when there is no sidewalk, walk facing traffic and far from moving vehicles as possible. And most of us never think about these things until we're suddenly stranded somewhere we never expected to be walking. Which is why, if your transportation disappears or you become separated from a group, I would avoid just starting down an unfamiliar highway unless you absolutely have to. Stay somewhere public, a truck stop, restaurant, hotel, fire station, police station, busy gas station. Somewhere with employees, cameras, phones, and other people around. And don't be embarrassed to ask for help. Adults sometimes hesitate because we don't want to make something dramatic. You think, I'm fine, I'll figure it out, I don't want police involved. You don't have to report a crime. You can simply say, I'm stranded, I don't know this area, I don't have a phone, can you help me get somewhere safe? And for families, I would say the same thing in reverse. If your adult child is in a residential recovery program that takes participants on overnight or interstate trips, ask questions. Who's driving? Where are they staying? How many staff members are traveling? Do participants have phones? What happens if someone walks away? How long do you look before calling police? Who contacts the family? Because a program regularly traveling with people dealing with addiction, depression, or PTSD should already have those answers. You shouldn't be inventing a missing person protocol in a parking lot after somebody disappears. And I think there's another uncomfortable issue here. When treatment and fundraising overlap, participants should know exactly what they're signing up for. And there's nothing inherently wrong with fundraising for a nonprofit or selling Christian literature. But someone entering a residential recovery program should know how much time they'll spend receiving services versus traveling, working, or raising money. Ask for the actual daily schedule, not just words like community, healing, discipleship, and personal growth. Ask, what happens at 8 in the morning? When do I see a counselor? How many hours am I on the road? How much fundraising am I expected to do? Those answers will tell you much more about the program than a mission statement. And if it's a faith-based program, I think you can respect the religious component while still demanding medical transparency. Those things can coexist. Prayer can help someone. Community can help someone. Faith can absolutely help someone. But addiction is still a medical condition. PTSD is still PTSD. Serious depression is still serious depression. And alcohol withdrawal, for example, can be medically dangerous. Look for licensed or accredited programs and ask specifically about evidence-based care and appropriate medical treatment. I think Graham's story offers an important lesson for the organizations themselves. If you choose to take vulnerable people across state lines, there should be emergency contacts. There should be a crisis plan. There should be a missing person procedure. People should have some way to communicate. There should be enough supervision that one staff member can stay behind if something goes wrong. And maybe none of these precautions would have changed what happened to Graham. We simply don't know. But safety is really about layers. A phone, emergency contact, safe public place, staff member following from a distance, a call home, a call to police. Sometimes one small layer is enough to keep a bad situation from becoming catastrophic. And whether you're joining a religious recovery program, volunteering with an organization, traveling with a tour group, or simply getting into a car with people you don't know very well, I think the lesson is the same. Don't hand over every layer of your independence just because you trust the people you're traveling with. Know where you are, know how you're getting home, keep a way to contact someone outside the group, and make sure somebody outside that vehicle knows where you are too. Graham's family is still waiting for the most important answer of all. What happened to him after he walked away that day? Someone may still know something. Maybe you saw Graham. Maybe you remember a vehicle, a person, or something unusual near the church or along the road. Even a detail that seemed insignificant at the time could matter now. Anyone with information can contact the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office at 888-624-2207. To remain anonymous, call Mecklenburg County Crime Solvers at 877-676-8477. Graham's family has spent nearly 2 years looking for answers. Hopefully someone out there can finally help give them one. And finally, remember to leave a review and rate this podcast 5 stars if you like the show, or hell, even if you don't. But either way, feel free to let me know what you think. Please follow The Last Trip on Instagram at The Last Trip Crime Pod, and subscribe on Patreon to support the show. You'll get extra research, videos, photos, and updates, and even learn more about my personal travels. That's patreon.com/thelasttrippodcast. I'm Jamie Beebe, bringing you your last trip and signing off until the next one. Thanks for listening.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Oh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Britsky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.